Okay. All right. So here we are in what I call the gulch of the year, right? Between Christmas and New Year. A little louder. Up, up, up. Okay. Louder. Okay. To proclaim the truth in clear and loud tones, right? So, it feels like even at Christmas time, when we're trying to celebrate and be happy with each other.
Up again, up more.
Okay. Maybe I can just hold it. I'll just hold it. How about this? Great. Okay. Oh my. So at Christmas time, when we try to be together with friends and family and share warmth and nourishment and good times, it feels like the only thing that we can talk about is our leadership. And I couldn't help but notice after the election that on Facebook, lots of Dharma teachers and other spiritual teachers put out essays on how to deal with this circumstance, which felt very dislodging and deeply disappointing and totally unreal. So I'm not going to try to create an essay justifying or reflecting on how we're supposed to deal with the circumstances now, but from the point of view of mindfulness practice, obviously there's some great discomfort. And to some degree or other, all of us as individuals and as a collective are experiencing deep discomfort. And as I reflected on it, I realized that it has something to do with how we relate to our leaders, to authority figures in our lives, beginning with our parents, our teachers, and finally the leaders that are world leaders, national leaders, people who take charge of our experience as humans in society. And we were very suspicious of that, especially Americans. In fact, our whole reason for being a separate country and having our own constitution was as a defense against authoritarianism and what I call bullyism. And now here we sit, faced with the absolute presence of authoritarian bullyism taking charge of our country and our lives. And it's not like this is the first time. I mean, many people have, after being elected, turned out to be less than what we expected or what we thought we voted for. But it's definitely a feeling of dismay, feeling out of control, and wondering what we can do. That's really the question that came out of so many people's mouths that I was with. What can we do? Forgetting that the principle of a democracy is to give the power to the people. So, as a therapist, people would come into my practice and say, I feel horrible. I feel so terrified. I feel sick. I'm getting physically ill in these circumstances, and I want you to fix it. What can we do to change the state? And, you know, I have to kind of sit back and say, well, I'm not sure that it's wise to change the state of anguish and feeling illness and feeling rage and feeling all the emotions that attend a sense of helplessness in the face of power that is corrupt or tends towards corruption. And in some way, it's a very noble and dignified way that we are taking as a populace, because we want to express our desire to not fall into the dark side. Just as the shadow begins to emanate, we want to separate out from it and say we're better than that. We don't want to support that. Do we have a voice? And as practitioners of mindfulness, do we just sit and cultivate calmness in the face of everything and anything? Is that appropriate? Is that what we want? And some people do interpret Buddhism and the practice of mindfulness as a very peaceful path that doesn't allow for strong action. But I think that that's a misinterpretation. The reason for practicing and arriving at a deep place of clarity and calm is so that our actions arise from wisdom rather than from reactivity. If we want to know what an action looks like that arises from reactivity, we can look at Trump's Twitterland. No impulse control. So coming to a place of clarity and peacefulness and calm doesn't mean that we are in a place of inaction. There's a wonderful frieze in the Khmer Art Museum in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, of ancient sacred Khmer sculpture. And one of the pieces that struck me more than any of the other pieces is a frieze. And one half of the frieze are positive spirits, white spirits or light spirits, and the other half of the frieze are dark spirits. And they're playing a tug of war. And this rope that they are pulling back and forth between each other is turned around a post right at the center of the dark spirits and the light spirits, the post. The rug is curled around it and then it is pulled back and forth. And so this piece of wood churns. And the explanation for this image is that as the light spirits and the dark spirits play the tug of war, they turn the piece of wood, and the piece of wood churns the cosmic milk, and that's how all manifestation is created. And I thought that was a very timeless, very non-judgmental view of experience. It's a balance. It's always a balance between what we call the light forces and what we call the dark forces, and it's in the interaction between these that manifestation generates. Our experience and all phenomena arise. But there's always a balance. And in my mind, I liken it to the yin-yang symbol, you know, the circle with the dark and the white patch. And in the complete visual version of this symbol, the dark patch has a white dot and the light patch has a dark dot. And as these two things move around each other, the light patch in the dark half gets larger and becomes the teardrop, and the dark path in the light object gets larger and becomes the dark fear top teardrop. So that one thing arises from the other. Lightness seems to arise out of the dark. Darkness seems to arise out of the light. And it's not just a general thing. It's not just it happening in society. It happens within us each as individuals. You know, we have moments when we have very, very balanced, very good, very spacious, expansive, empathic, loving thoughts and feelings and behaviors. And there's times when we don't even recognize who we're becoming. We seem like a monster. And then there's everything in between. So I guess that's my way of calming myself down and saying everything, even though it feels like it's in a dark corner of reality at this moment, is in a state of balance. There will be a countervailing force. And we are the countervailing force. So this is no time to look for release from discomfort and despair. This is a time to adapt the very skills that we learn as mindfulness practitioners to actually relax and expand into whatever state our mind, our body, or our heart bring up in the moment. To not say, oh my God, I can't stand this, I can't wait till it stops. But expand. Let the emotion do its work. Emotions and feelings are also the products of wisdom. They have a message to give us that is worth listening to. You know, we live in a society where there's a promise of instant relief. And I'm tired, so I can instantly relieve myself into being awake by having a cup of coffee, or I can just find a bed and go to sleep. As I was walking, I finally found a place to park, and as I was walking from there around the corner to the church, I realized there's some people whose only place they have to sleep is outside in the street. Not a great relief from the discomfort of being exhausted. So if we have feelings of disappointment or what they call malaise, a feeling of really deep moral discomfort, there's something there to pay attention to. There's something there that will awaken the warrior in us and also guide us to right action, right activism. That doesn't arise from aversion. It doesn't arise from reactivity. It arises from seeing through to the bottom of things. And when we see through to the bottom of things, the right action becomes self-evident. It's just a natural thing. The main thing is that action doesn't arise from deep aversion. But the emotions that attend to aversion, discomfort, disappointment, disillusion, disbelief, whatever feelings you've been having over these last weeks, those are factors of wisdom because they do guide you to a moral strength. Buddhism has a spine of moral strength. It's called the Eightfold Path. It's a way of aligning ourselves to being good human beings in society. Listening, being wise, telling the truth, practicing, not harming others, not harming ourselves, cultivating empathy, goodwill, and kindness. And all those things can actually be instruments for activism. It doesn't have to be hatred and rage. You know, we've always had a tradition of being suspicious of authority. But then somehow we kind of begin to go to sleep on it. Until something really, really horrible happens. And then we wake up in the middle of a nightmare and realize it's really happening. So we shouldn't go to sleep. We should stay vigilant, pay attention to what's going on, cultivate calmness and expansiveness so that the feelings and the emotions that arise from that vigilance can be sustained, can do their work, can graduate us to wise activism, wherever we find it, whatever shape it takes. You know, one of the things that historians and social psychologists say is under the pressure of extreme patronizing authority, people seem to become helpless and powerless. So we've been awakened from our apathy, but we shouldn't go from that into a feeling of helplessness and powerlessness. We should actually invite our emotions and our responses to the truth of each moment to guide us in right action. And this also means right activism. Let your voice be heard. Let your insights be shared. Let's come together and be a group that is activist in a positive way, that brings more freedom, more liberation, more understanding, instead of divisiveness, hatred, and greed, sheer greed. I think it's amazing that at a time like the 21st century in America, because of who has been elected president, all of a sudden the archetype of the Second World War, Adolf Hitler, has arisen yet again in our awareness, as if we have never really digested and dealt with the horror of what's possible deeply enough to eradicate it and the roots of it from our humanity. And so, like, as individuals, if we don't work something clear, it remanifests in our lives over and over and over again, giving us an opportunity to look deeper, to understand it more skillfully, and to eradicate it through insight. So as a group of people, there's something about our own inner violence and sometimes genocidal tendencies that seems to recur in cycles and seems to say, why don't we as human species awaken and have more insight into the roots of this kind of violence and this kind of hatred and lack of compassion? And so maybe this is a time when the opportunity to reflect on that has really arrived yet again. Even though so many of the conditions that usually lead to the affliction of authoritarianism and violence and finally genocide are not really happening in this country right now. We're pretty comfortable. Although I know they say that we're in a bubble on the West Coast and we're in a bubble on the East Coast, but I think even the central part of the country is in a bubble. Different bubble, different domain, but also a bubble. And they will be waking up soon and shockingly, like we have been, for different reasons. But I also feel that when we are in the presence of energy that is out of control and very reactive and very impulsive, it's good for us, in response to that, to become tranquil, to become centered, to clear our sensory system so that we really see things as they really are, to calm our nervous system so that our actions are wise rather than reactive, so that we can be part of that light spirit row of spirits that keep the world in balance even when darkness arises. And I think that there's two very important means for achieving that. The one is practice that calms us down, and the other is communication and connectedness amongst each other. And principally being able to hear even those things that we disagree with an open ear and an open heart. And allow each individual to have their own perceptions at that moment. We don't have to correct people. We just have to be true to the root of our own clarity and wisdom. And we can express it in ways that allow it to be more easily received. We don't have to be confrontive. So that we can be, you know, warriors of peace and inclusion with a sense of sharing and a sense of humanity and the idea that humanity can lift itself away from violence and genocide, racism and greed. This is our opportunity, this is our moment. And one of the ways of getting the strength to be able to be those kinds of warriors is to be able to expand and sustain uncomfortable feelings and emotions, and use them as the rudders that give us direction for seeing into the light of things. And principally, don't feel like giving up and becoming apathetic again and just saying it's all fucked. You know, this country was founded on the idea that it was the people that had the last word and the ultimate power. And we are they. We are them. And they are too. So I invite any reflections or questions or comments or insights coming from you guys too. Yes, this way you can be heard, and you're also recorded in the Dharma talk, so people know what I'm responding to. Anybody? That's interesting. Has this been your experience? I mean, am I talking? Am I connecting with your experience in my talk? Yeah? Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Okay. Anybody have any questions about practice? Back to the rudimentaries? Yes.
I'm just wondering if you could say a little more about listening with an open heart and an open mind.
Yes. You know, I sometimes feel that everything that we do, all our thought movements, all of our moment-to-moment subjective experience has one point. We're trying to find ourselves. We're defining our identity in all the different contexts that our thoughts take us to. And because of that, And the instability of that, because as you know, it's hard to find a substantial identity at any time, except for everything that the sensory system represents in any given moment, from moment to moment. So we understand the insecurity that we live in, and as a result of it, we're prompted to need to be right. That's our crutch for people who think that we're somebody, but we're not sure who we are, and at any moment we'll discover it. And so the compulsion to need to be right is very powerful, and it keeps us from being able to really receive clearly communication from others. Because most of the time when we're listening or talking or sharing in conversation, we're not really listening, we're preparing our response, or we're managing our internal response to what we're hearing. And if we're not compelled to need to be right, then we can relax and just let the information come through us. And we don't have to judge the person or say, oh, now I know what you believe. Now I have an assessment about who you are, what your value is, right? So if we can drop those three assumptions, then our heart is open to whoever is communicating with us, and we can really hear what they're saying. We might agree, we might disagree. It's not about agreement or disagreement. It's about, oh, now I understand your feeling in this moment, I think. So it's a kind of open receptivity rather than looking to see, oh, let's argue this point, or I don't like you for believing that, or I only heard the first three words because I had this emotional response that arose so powerfully, you know? So it's got something to do with getting looser about our need to be someone who is right or who has the right view. It's a hard sell, but it's a worthy path. I had a teacher once, a guy named Richard Bandler. He was teaching neurolinguistics, and he used to work a lot with couples. You know, couples are a place where I'm right, you're wrong kind of stuff really comes in very powerfully. And so he finally threw up his hands and he said, I came to the conclusion the therapeutic response to couples is just one question to them. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? You know, two people can disagree about something fundamental, but they can still be happy together. And there comes a point when if harm is being done, then you want to be able to take some action. I mean, that's just a human response, which is totally appropriate. But it's important to know exactly what the action is that you're responding to and how you want your response to be effective, rather than just adding, you know, fuel to the fire. With Donald Trump, people get so excited about him that I think if he were in the room, our excitement would actually make him even crazier. So the idea is when somebody's frothing up, the idea is to chill, you know? Don't add to it. Because I think he loves fighting with people who are all excited about how horrible he is. Although he's also very sensitive, you know? It'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting 4 years. Great for practice. We'll really be driven to our zafus more than once a day. Yeah.
Speaking of practice, I don't know if it's... Oh, yeah. Thank you for all that you've said so far. And speaking of practice, I know that's too personal, but I'm curious what your daily practice looks like. I've incorporated one over the last year, so I'm always curious to hear how other people, what they do.
You've incorporated a daily practice over the last year? Wow. You have to write the how-to book.
Okay.
Because people have a hard time with daily practice, especially if it's on their own. I make it a point to meditate in the morning, sometimes just 15 minutes, sometimes half an hour, and also in the evening. Morning and evening are good times. Morning, because even if we've slept for 8 or 10 hours, during the sleep phase, our attention is not present. So the dreams are just recycling emotions and conditioned stories. And so we wake up having slept a long time, but we're still exhausted because emotionally we've gone through the ringer. So it's good to just refresh from waking up by sitting for at least 15 minutes before doing anything, really. And at the end of the day, we've had real life stimulation that's been churning inside and around us. And so it's good to take a 20-minute practice before we go to sleep, so that when we do go to sleep, we have a chance to actually relax in our sleep rather than work through all the stuff that we didn't digest during the day. So I like to practice for 15 to 20 minutes after I wake up and before I go to sleep. If I find myself very distressed during the day, then I will take whatever time I have to just connect in. And it doesn't have to be formal. It can just be breathing and counting 1 to 5 breaths and then 5 to 1, you know, maybe 3 times, maybe 5 times a cycle, and then doing a little bit of body scanning, and then, you know, back on track again. But people do have a hard time practicing on their own. There is a different feeling, too, when you're practicing in a group. I like to say we connect with big mind, and it's supportive of a powerful kind of like going down into the depths of our psyche and finding a place where the map of our identity no longer is present. It's just awareness. Okay, yeah. Any other questions about practice, about the 2 P's, practice and politics? Okay.
Hello. Thank you so much for talking. I'm really enjoying today, your conversation. I noticed that you meditated with your eyes open for a section. Is that, I go to a Zen group sometimes, and they always encourage that. I'm just curious if the pros and cons.
Pros and cons of meditating with eyes open or eyes shut? Eyes open is actually, they're half open. So I'm just focusing on some of a spot on the ground there. Sometimes that I find, if I close my eyes, I have more access to what's going, the tumble of thoughts. And if my eyes are slightly open, then my mind has a tendency to get quiet. And so I try to anchor myself in quiet mind for the first 10 and 15 minutes, and then I close my eyes. And then the whole system is calmed down. I think that fantasy is activated through closing the eyes. And when we have a visual field which is specific, then the internal fantasy is actually reduced. But that's my experience, so you can try it out for yourself and see. You know, our senses, when they're actually in touch with what's going on in the world, are very, very grounding. But when we close our eyes and close our, especially our eyes, but our ears as well, we're left with our internal world, which is very, it just, you know, it's moving. It's telling tomes and tomes of stories. And what are they connected to? What is the reality behind them? They're just interpretations of what our sensory system picked up a while ago and how it organized itself and generalized. So I think practicing with eyes open, being in the middle of life, not, you know, necessarily creating a space that has to be quiet or has to be dark or all those things that people command as must-haves for good practice, they might be supportive for a while, but eventually we have to be with our awake and open senses in the midst of life, in the world, with a sense of calm and wisdom and presence of being that is cultivated through practice but actually merges into so-called real life. Yeah.
So, thank you for Sophia Lopez for my talk.
Thank you for what? I didn't hear.
Oh, I said this is the other P going back to politics.
The other P, yes. So, yes.
Thank you very much for your great and kind and helpful. And yes, just.
I'm glad. I'm glad they're helpful. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about it for so long. It's okay.
But the thing I struggle with the most, and I'm not sure if either you have this great benefit of having both the Buddhist perspective and also a therapeutic perspective on things. And the thing I struggle with the most is the people acting not in their own self-interest. Like the Dharma says, we just are to accept people as they are and where they are. But if they are acting in a way that's harmful to both themselves and others without that being their intention,
well, you know, I mean, radical acceptance, you know, is what you're talking about, and it is sometimes espoused in the Dharma, especially radical self-acceptance, because we're so hypercritical of ourselves. But, you know, I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors. I wish to hell that the German people had risen up and changed the politics of that time, because my family would have survived, you know. So, if I see somebody causing harm, I have the feeling that I don't want to just accept it. But I don't want to, like, you know, rage and just add more violence on top of violence. You know, for me, it's animals. I feel very strongly that they are at the mercy of our lack of awareness about how they feel and how sensitive they are and how cruelly they are treated. But this also goes from human to human. I mean, we have 60 million refugees plus on the planet right now. It's the second generation being born in these camps that have no medical, no food, nowhere to go, no past that they can rely on, no future that they can envision. And whenever the Doctors Without Borders sets up a hospital or goes there, they get bombed. It's unbelievable. So there's nothing to say, I have to radically accept this. I know it's true. I know it's happening, but I don't feel good about it. And if I decide to focus on some aspect of that and allow my not feeling good to guide me in that, you know, to reflect more deeply about those conditions, then maybe some action will arise that mobilizes me. So that's a strategy for activism that I can support, which includes acceptance, but not acceptance of harm. You know, if you see somebody being harassed on the street because they're sleeping in a sleeping bag and leaning up against a cold brick building trying to warm themselves when it's 30 degrees out there, and somebody comes and mistreats them and I happen to be there, I can't accept that. No. I can accept how uncomfortable it makes me feel and get to a place where maybe I'm balanced enough that I can actually tell this person to not behave that way in a way that is strong but not aggressive, right? I don't want to add to the fuel of the fire. That's the whole thing, because then it just escalates, you know, how that can be. Yeah. There's a lot of suffering that we can respond to right now. And I think in a way we've been awakened to how much suffering there is and how sometimes the solutions that people look for to resolve the suffering are so the wrong solutions. You know, when Hitler arose in Germany, German people were truly, you know, after the First World War, they lost everything. They were impoverished. They had lost their power as a nation. They had no money. They didn't have enough food. People were really crushed. And as a result of it, a really terrible despotic leader could take over. We're not in that situation right now. But the way that we deal with people who are unhappy in the long run will help us be more peaceful. Whether we're the spirits of light or whether we're the spirits of darkness. But remembering that it's all balanced that way and it manifests our life. This tug of war, moral tug of war in a way that we're constantly in. And within ourselves as well. You know, one minute you have a feeling and then the next minute you realize, that's not me, I don't feel that way. But I did, but I don't now. You know. This all relates also to the Buddhist principle that nothing is steady. Everything is in a constant state of flux. You know, there's a kind of incredible moral ambiguity that we're constantly trying to move through and get some clarity. And I'm not sure that any of us have any answers. I think that what we want to use as guides are our feelings and our emotions. Doesn't mean that we react on the basis of them. We reflect on them and we expand and allow them to inform us. You know, when we feel despondent and disgusted, we need to be in that state so that maybe something can arise that is an insight about, oh, this is what I can do. But the very fact that people have been so insistent on what can we do so quickly, you know, the news comes out, the shock is there, and everybody wants a resolution instantly. Immediately, we're in the society where relief is ever-present and demanded in the moment so that we can't fully appreciate the wisdom of how this whole system is responding to things and listening to the feelings that arise from that response as a directive, as an informant. We need to be able to live in some discomfort in order to have that process complete. And then we're in wise action. So that's what I'm recommending. So it's practice in action, you know, meditation in action. Yeah. There was a book in the early 70s written by a wonderful Tibetan teacher named Chogyam Trungpa, who wanted to address this idea that, you know, practice actually belongs in the middle of everyday life, to normal everyday us. And the title of it was called Meditation in Action. So all these people who did nothing but sit on their duff for 3 months also were doing it so that they could have meditation become part of active life. That's where it belongs. This is sharpening the tool, then we need to use it. Does that make sense? Otherwise, we, you know, it would be true, you know, people's derisive description of meditators as people who reflect on their navels. and don't have any other interests. You know, just it's all about this. Forget that. It's all about this all of the time. That's not the purpose of it. This is actually a very dynamic. I mean, when we're practicing, we don't move. We don't even blink. But it's a very dynamic, very powerful thing to do. And it's the most disruptive thing that we can do in the midst of life. Sit down, do nothing. And you know it's disruptive because our whole system gets agitated the moment we think about doing it. It's like, no, not right now. Tomorrow, maybe. No, you've done it 7 minutes. You've got another 7 minutes. Can you stand it? You know, the agitation, the constant churning. It's hard to stop. Anybody else? One more, because it's 9 o'clock. Yes. Where's the mic? Okay, well, losing hope. In other words, we're just getting into darker and darker and darker and darker. Well, I don't know. I think that's your experience. I'm not going to argue that that's not the right experience to have because it's your experience, so I respect that. But I think it's all, from my perspective, I like to stay in the tension that both are present equally. That's a tension there. Because if I were to say, oh shit, everything's going down the toilet, then it would be a kind of laziness, a kind of giving up. And I, myself, am not comfortable doing that. I want to stay in the tension. I'd rather be in the discomfort of the tension. I don't know where the light's going to come from. I trust it's going to come from all of us in infinite ways. And also, I trust a little bit in the way that the government has been organized to have some counterbalance so that people, nobody can be an absolute king, right? That's why we left England. Absolute authority corrupts absolutely, right? And that's a lot of what we represent as a country, the alternative to that. That's why it's called democracy. So we get to watch and see if it works, how it works, how we can be a part of it working. You know, we're not helpless. There is a helplessness and a powerlessness that people have a tendency to fall into in the face of authoritarian leadership. So to be awake to that, to not let that sleep happen, is, I think, the challenge. You know, giving up, that's not an answer, really. And so, hopelessness, hopefulness, what do they have to do? They're states. Hopelessness means I've seen it all and I don't believe it's going to change. Hopefulness says I can project anything into the future that could be bright, but it's got nothing to do with the present moment, where we can be either awake, practicing, alert, mindfulness, engage our response so that it's balanced. What does that have to do with hopelessness or hopefulness? Nothing really. So, hopelessness is the doorway to despair. I mean, you can expand and explore despair and see where that takes you, but yeah, you can do that and see if there's a white light growing in the middle of that despair that comes from someplace that you don't know exists even, and that begins to grow. That's what the yin-yang symbol is saying. Okay, let's just have a few more minutes to sit before we go out, and then we'll have our Dana talk. Get ready. Okay. Just a few minutes. Thank you very much for showing up. Happy New Year.
Thanks, everybody. Just a quick reminder that and that Yvonne and whoever teaches here offers the teachings freely and is only supported by our donations. Also, Mission Dharma, we have $156 a night room rental and other expenses throughout the year. The only way that we're able to meet those expenses is through the donations, the generosity that everyone provides every week, which we so much appreciate. Otherwise, the teachings are freely offered, so there's no fee for service. We have a $5 to $25 suggested donation, which is just a suggestion, and there are several ways you can give. You can give with cash in the basket in the back or over here on the ornament. You can give online via PayPal, and you can write a check out if you'd like to send it. Please write it out to Mission Dharma. Please put your email in the memo line so we can send you a tax acknowledgement whether you are a 501c3 organization. So your contributions are tax deductible, and we'll send you a tax acknowledgement letter. And again, we just appreciate your generosity so much. Thank you so much, Yvonne, for addressing the really difficult questions that a lot of us are facing right now. And any generosity you have to help support Yvonne so that she can continue to give these teachings would be very, very much appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.